This episode of Addiction, an Hour with Hour, is brought to you by Gaming Laboratories International. GLI is a world-class testing, inspections, and certification company committed to delivering the highest quality land-based, lottery, and iGaming testing and assessment services around the world. GLI provides suppliers, operators, and regulators with expert guidance for navigating the future of gaming and ensuring gaming innovations meet regulatory standards with confidence in more than 710 jurisdictions. For more information, visit GamingLabs.com. Hello and welcome to Addiction, an Hour with Hour. If you've listened before, you might be able to tell from my accent that I am not, in fact, the eponymous Hour. Neither of them, actually. I'm John Bruford, one of your hosts, but the less important one. We're joined by His Eminence. Is it okay to still call you that, Your Holiness? Dr. Michael Hour. Dr. Hour,
don't
hello.
As long as you don't call me names, it's okay. And don't discriminate names. Me because of my language, okay?
I would never.
I feel offended.
I mean, there have been some terrific Austrians through history.
Absolutely. Strong ones.
Yes. Yes. Arnold. was Mozart Austrian?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He was pretty great.
From Salzburg and Vienna. I'm not sure where he was originally from.
Keep your mouth close to the microphone, I'm just saying.
My microphone is around my neck, man.
Yeah, I know, but if you lift your head up, it's further away from the microphone, isn't it?
Okay, I'll stay still.
Staying still is good. It reaps dividends in this kind of... And I'm not editing any of this out. People are going to know that I told a doctor how to do
things. Yeah, it's different today because I'm in a hotel room. I can't say where. I can't disclose my location. Sorry, but...
Oh, you're serious?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm in Thessaloniki in Greece.
Well, you just disclosed your location.
Yeah.
The fuck?
Maybe it's not the right one, you know? Maybe it's a deception.
Oh, yeah, you're good at this. Mm-hmm. Shit, man, this is why you're a doctor and I'm just a peon. If that, a pleb.
You're still helpful to some degree.
Yeah, for carrying heavy objects for people. That's it. I figure in the event of a zombie apocalypse, my one skill is lifting large, heavy objects. And as I'm now way older than I used to be, I'm not even very good at that anymore. I think I'm just going to be doomed to be chewed to death. Sad times. What skills would you bring to a zombie apocalypse, Dr. Hour?
Won't respond to any of that because we have a very interesting guest and I want to fire lots of questions at him, okay?
My God, you're so efficient.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Those cliches, they're true. we are, in fact, joined by a very interesting guest, joined by Dr. Rob Hirine. Have I said your surname right, Rob?
Yep, you got it.
Woohoo! Get this. He is a research fellow at the Gambling Treatment and Research Clinic and the Brain and Mind Centre at the University of Sydney. Yes, I had to write that down and read it out because I wasn't going to remember all those words. I'd have probably remembered research fellow. I'd have been all right. And then after that. So, Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, John, Michael. Great to be here. I'm just glad I don't have to respond to the zombie apocalypse question now.
You can
if you want. I'm starting to think in my mind of what skills I could bring, but I haven't come up with one just yet. So maybe give me some time.
But that was going to be my opening question to you. Because I'm not a doctor. Yeah. You're both doctors. Do you know what I mean? I'm keeping the conversation at a working class level.
I can't say it was part of my doctoral training specifically, but maybe I do have four children, so I'm good at organizing things.
So reproduction. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's repopulation.
Bisse lemming.
We laugh, but those would be, you know, a fertile remaining population.
Rob, just, you know, to make sure, I mean, you're talking about your biological children, not cult followers or something like this.
No, biological children.
Okay.
Where the hell did you pull that from?
You're talking about your biological children, not some people that you keep in your cellar and you call my children. You are all my children.
Exactly. You never know. I mean, these days, yeah, it's very fair. You know, yeah, absolutely fair.
The British accent hides a lot. Where are you from, Rob?
I'm from South Wales, near Newport.
Oh. Hmm. It wouldn't be like Cumbrian or somewhere around there, would it?
Risca. So just north in the valleys, up above Newport. I say Newport because everyone knows where Newport is, but I don't like to associate with it too much.
It's fair. I've been there. I'm in Prestine right now, so I'm in Wales. Oh. I've got 3 sheep on a treadmill powering the internet for me.
I'm going to see Tom Jones in the summer. He's from Wales, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Live.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pretty cool, right?
Is it though?
Absolutely. Don't say anything.
If you live in Wales, occasionally you meet somebody who's got some connection to Tom Jones. There's always somebody's auntie who worked with Tom Jones at some point in their life.
But isn't Robert Plant also from that region? No? Am I wrong?
Robert Plant's sort of from the Kidderminster-ish region, and you frequently find him in Ludlow, my hometown.
Mm.
I once almost gave him some change because he was sitting on the steps of the Buttercross looking like he was begging, but he wasn't. He was just sitting there drinking a cup of coffee. Well, thank fuck I didn't put my coins in your drink there. What a story that would have been for the grandchildren. Robert, who? I nearly went entirely off topic then, because I went to see the Jeff Buckley documentary yesterday at the cinema, and there's quite a lot of Led Zeppelin stuff in there. If anybody out there has not seen the Jeff Buckley documentary, hearty recommend. Rob, what's your bread and butter? You're a research fellow at Gambling Treatment and Research Clinic, but do you have a particular focus of your research?
Yeah, I guess most of my research centers around using operator data, whether that's from land-based casino venues or clubs or online operators, trying to use that data to either identify signs of risky play and problem gambling or to evaluate policies that have been implemented by governments at different times and try and sort of maybe use natural experiments to look at whether they're working or not. And survey people and combine that with their account data to try and understand, again, are these harm reduction policies that they put in place with often little thought and little evaluation, are they actually working?
Okay. I'm not trying to cut the podcast really, really short here, but are they working?
Partially.
Okay. A partial success, like hand grenade proof underpants.
Yes.
It's psychology at the end of the day, right? Now, I think it's really important, you know, to emphasize that we're talking about human behavior, psychology, which doesn't follow, you know, the laws of physics. It's not always okay if one does this, then that's going to happen. But, you know, it's going to work in some cases, in others it won't work. Depends on the person. Lots of circumstances, because I mean, there have been review papers which said, okay, you know, pre-commitment doesn't work, or which I don't agree, you know, I think it works to some degree if it's implemented in a certain way. Like, example is operators often have to provide the option for players to set limits. But if this option is hidden somewhere in, you know, the sub areas of a web page or an app, then very few players will use it. If players are prompted to update, to set limits, let's say every time they log in or regularly, or even incentivized, they're going to be, you know, using this more often. So it really depends how things are implemented. Right, Rob?
Yeah, absolutely. We did some research back in 2019 looking at this exactly. There was an Australian government change to all online wagering sites, which required them to just basically prompt people to set a limit and say, when they signed up for their account or if they already had an account, do you want to set a limit, yes or no? Essentially more of an opt-out system rather than an opt-in. And just that really simple change led to a pretty dramatic increase in the number of limits that were being set in every month, much more than when we just tried to message people and send them interesting messages that we created with different taglines, trying to encourage them to use deposit limits. Just a really simple opt-out, opt-in seemed to be much more effective.
Mm. So one thing that I think I'd really like to discuss and get your opinion is the prediction of potentially, you know, problematic gambling. So we discussed this before. You published papers on that topic. I published paper on the topic. And we know that, you know, overall, there are very, very few studies that have actually approached the subject the way we think is right. Can you maybe sort of, you know, give a step-by-step guideline how that should be done and why many of the studies that, you know, claim to predict problem gambling or, you know, many approaches also by operators in-house, you know, are not valid in your opinion?
Okay, that's a big task.
Yeah, I know. Sorry.
there's a lot there. So first of all, you said about what operators are doing in-house. I think one of the big problems we have is there's just a complete lack of transparency in regards to how they're developing their models and how they perform. There's not really much information available about whether these things actually work. There's no sort of external validation. Or very rarely is there, and companies aren't willing to sort of publicize that information. And that's one of the reasons why I think Kaz, who you had on here, led that paper that I co-wrote with him and other colleagues, suggesting that we should have a sort of benchmarking system where companies, whether it's the gambling operators themselves or a third-party provider of these services, should be able to see how their models perform on sort of benchmark data sets that are openly available. To add that layer of transparency. In terms of the research then and what's been done, historically, as you know, most of it's been done based on trying to predict self-exclusion as the outcome variable. And the outcome variable is absolutely essential. This is kind of the most important part of all of this work. What are we actually trying to identify? What are we trying to predict?
Yep.
And as Kazra said when he was on your podcast, self-exclusion, it is an outcome. It serves a purpose. It has some value. It's easily sort of identifiable and labeled. People can see it in the data. They know whether any of their customers have self-excluded or haven't self-excluded. So it's practically very useful. From a commercial perspective, it also might be a pretty good thing to look at because I imagine most operators don't want their customers to self-exclude. So if they can try and identify and preempt somebody who's going to self-exclude and intervene and stop that, that's probably good from a commercial perspective. But again, it comes down to what we're actually trying to do here. And if we're trying to identify people who are at risk of gambling problems and gambling harm, there's a whole host of issues with it that we can sort of talk through. One of them is that just so few people do it. Even the studies that follow or look at data over a really long period of time, they're finding less than 1% of customers are self-excluding. Within that group of self-excluders, there's sort of heterogeneous reasons for why they do it, which we can talk about in a moment. But this leads to a lot of problems then in terms of then developing models to predict self-exclusion for a variety of different reasons. One of them is that because the positive class, the people who have the thing that we're trying to identify, is so small in number, less than 1% of the sample, if this work isn't done right, if they don't account for that, all the models will do is just try and perform as best as they can. So they're just optimized for saying everyone is not a problem gambler. And that's the sort of easiest solution for them to say, if only less than 1% of people have gambling problems, you can achieve 99% accuracy by just saying everyone in the data set is not a problem gambler. There's obviously ways we can account for that in practice to try and avoid that issue. But even when we do that, we try and say oversample and overrepresent this positive class, the people who self-exclude in our data. If they are really small in number and our data set isn't really, really great and detailed, over a long period of time, that positive class is not going to be very representative. So we just kind of are creating these fake or duplicate cases of people who self-exclude, and our model is going to work really well in that context potentially, but then when you apply it to real world data in a real world context, it's not going to do that great. But another problem with self-exclusion more broadly is that just most people, again, don't do it even when they're experiencing problems. So it's less than 1% of the total customer base, but I've done some initial research looking at this and the data we've got. I haven't published it yet, but looking at a survey of customers we did with a couple of operators, we've got about 2,000 people's PGSI responses, and we have data for the 6 months after the survey, as well as the year before they took the survey, which is really useful because then we can see what did people do who reported having sort of high risk problem gambling scores on the PGSI. And we see that of the people that are in these high risk categories that should be self-excluders, in the 6 months after the survey, less than 1% of them, like 0.1% essentially, go on to self-exclude. So it's really suggesting that very, very few people, even those who've got problems, are going to actually self-exclude over a sort of pretty meaningful time frame. I know it's only 6 months, but you'd expect a reasonable proportion of people who are already saying they've got problems to self-exclude within 6 months if it's truly an issue for them. And another issue with it relates to something that I think you've talked about before, Michael. Of those less than 1% people who decide that they're going to self-exclude, potentially these are the people who are making really positive steps to change their behavior. So they're already past the point of where you should have identified them. They're at the point of changing. And really, we want to identify those people who are at risk of, or they're already starting to experience harms before they might be necessarily making more severe changes like self-excluding from the site. There's a whole host of other potential issues with self-exclusion. We see research showing, for example, that a large proportion of the people who self-exclude do so within a really short time frame of registering. So some studies find that like within 1 day of registering, 25% of people self-exclude, and then 50% within 2 weeks or so. And what this might be is that people are signing up for sites, but they've already got a gambling problem, and it's maybe an impulse decision, and then they maybe place a couple of bets and they self-exclude again. But the problem with that then is that you have people with like a day of data or less, some people with no data at all, and you can't really use then the tracking data to do anything meaningful to predict these cases. So all of these issues that I've talked about in terms of it being such a small sample, and then you get a reasonable proportion, even the majority in some cases, who've got less than 2 weeks of data. So again, it's practically easy to look at, but it's definitely not ideal. There are other approaches that operators have taken. I think in Spain, you know, you've talked about this on the podcast before, the regulator. I think what they did is actually really interesting, although it probably has similar limitations. I think they looked at data from people who'd access treatment services for problem gambling. Mm-hmm. So that is a very clear signal, obviously, that somebody's got problems. It's not like there's mixed reasons for seeking treatment, like there might mm-hmm. be with self-exclusion. But I think, again, there's potentially going to be it's only going to be a very small subsample of people, and it's already those people who are making a positive step to change their behavior. So I think the ideal way to do this, although there's certainly limitations, is through looking at self-reported problem gambling scores. Obviously, we all know the PGSI is the most common measure, and there are issues with that that we can definitely get into. But there have been about, I think we found recently, about 10 to 11 studies that have applied this method, and all of them have taken a slightly different approach. And we, Michael, as you know, we're doing a systematic review of that literature at the moment to try and synthesize it, try and understand what we know, how well these models are doing in this context. But what they're typically doing then is building these models based on somewhere between often 6 months and 12 months of historical data. And using those to try and, again, identify who is and isn't scoring higher on the PGSI, often scores of 5+ or 8+. So that's it in a nutshell. I'm sure there's lots that I missed out there, but yeah.
Yeah. No, I think the point really is, and I think one cannot emphasize enough, it's the target variable. And that, you know, whatever target variable you are using, that sort of will determine what you are predicting and how you are assessing. And I mean, it even goes so far that some operators are using like in-house assessment, right? So they would say, okay, we have a team of customer safety specialists and these responsible gaming analysts, and sort of they determine who is at risk and not at risk based on playing behavior, maybe player communication, and that's how they are building then the score. And then, of course, what you do is you kind of build like a self-explanatory system, because you are kind of, you know, score, your model will explain what your staff is doing at the end of the day. But yeah. I mean, I had even a call with a regulator, European regulator, quite a couple of weeks ago, and I'm not sure if I really was able to make my point. You know, it's really hard somehow, because people come up then with all sorts of course, valid critique too, because if you run, you know, let's say you ask players to answer the PGSI or any other questionnaire, and of course, some of them will not answer. You can't force them to answer. So you have a selected, of course, a selective sample of responses. Then some will not answer it honestly, or not just not even take the time to do it. But that's simply psychology, right? If, you know, a clinical psychologist is screening a person for whatever, they might also not answer honestly. So it's psychological. There is no definitive way to assess whether somebody, you know, tells the truth or not. That's why there are, you know, lie detector tests, isn't it? I mean, you just gotta trust, okay, what at the end of the day you receive and work with it, because it's not something biological, it's not something genetical. You can't run like a PCR test or a blood test in order to find out whether somebody is a problem gambler. And I mean, maybe one of the reasons that self-exclusion was used before is because the number is also pretty low, isn't it? I mean, it depends on the regulation. It depends on the operator. You mentioned before, we have like, you know, whatever in a period of time, 1-2% of self-excluders. And all of the studies that, you know, I am now familiar with, they pretty much found that about 20% of an online gambling population, let's say excluding lottery draw products, of an online casino sports betting population, report that they have gambling problems based on the PGSI or a similar screen. And that's quite a quite high number if you consider that the prevalence rate of problem gambling in the population is around 1% or even lower. However, when we talk about population, we talk about, you know, all adults, and not everybody gambles. And when we talk about the online casino, online sports betting population, we of course have only adults who are engaging into that activity. So at the end of the day, it makes sense again. On the other hand, most of the operators and algorithms and systems I'm familiar with out there assess about 1% or so as problem gamblers.
Yeah, there's a lot there to comment on. The first thing you said was about the operators that come up with their own labels for people, and then they try and predict that. In medical diagnostic research, that's called circularity, using sort of the same variables in the diagnosis as you are in the new tool that you're trying to validate, essentially. So yeah, operators are, say, making these labels. They're saying this person's gambling frequently and therefore they're more at risk. And then they're developing a model using gambling frequency to try and predict this outcome. And of course, there's going to be this inflated sort of performance of this model. That's like really, really frowned upon in medical research. It's something that hasn't really been picked up on here. Another thing you said then is about when people take problem self-reported measures of problem gambling, about the sort of whether people are replying honestly or not. I think that's like an inherent problem in all survey research and these types of studies. And we're never going to fully solve that, but there are ways we can sort of work around that. We can include little measures of attention, for example, in the PGSI, and make sure that people are actually responding appropriately. They're reading all of the items before responding rather than just clicking all the buttons as they go through. And then the other thing you said was about there's no sort of definitive marker of problem gambling. And this relates to the PGSI and why I think it's useful, because in any other scenario relating to mental health, we're always asking people about their symptoms. We're asking people about a subjective state that they're experiencing. You're right, we can't definitively say whether somebody's experiencing a gambling problem based on their behavioral data. It's not like somebody spends this amount, they gamble this amount, they've got a problem. It's a subjective experience. It's relative to their income, their resources, and so on. So we do need to ask people. We have to understand their personal experience. And that does make it very complicated. And I was thinking about this just before coming on to the podcast, how, and maybe I'm wrong and I haven't thought about this enough, I don't think there's any other area of life where we're using sort of this detailed behavioral data about an individual to try and understand their mental state. We're following people over time. We've got very, very detailed information about them. And we're trying to use that to predict how they're feeling, how they're coping, and their level of risk. Mm. I mean, people are probably doing this in like a commercial setting for commercial reasons to try and push people towards buying products and certain products they think will be interesting to them, advertisements and so on. But I don't think there's any other area of sort of like mental health research or health research that does this, which makes it such an interesting problem to try and solve.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, comparable areas, like let's say smoking, drinking, you don't have this objective trail of behavior that's, you know, measured, that's really specific to online gambling, online betting, and maybe land-based if there are loyalty cards either, you know, partially used or completely used. But I mean, one thing that's also like interesting is, so predicting, you know, problem gambling, what if you had like a more complete picture of a person's affordability, right? Because let's say you have a player who says they have a problem based on PGSI, but their spending is very low compared to their income or, you know, their wealth. And on the other hand, you know, it could be the other, somebody saying, okay, I don't have a problem at all, but when you look at their spending and compare it with their money available, you see that they are sort of, you know, maxing out, and their gambling spending, you know, is really critical compared to how much they actually have. So would be interesting, right, to have affordability additionally, and maybe whatever, you know, substitute that, because in lots of regulation, I see that money is actually sort of, to them, the most crucial aspect. It's about, okay, people should not gamble more than they can afford to use. We don't care about whether they have a problem or not, but what's important is that they don't spend more they can afford to lose. And you see that in lots of European regulations where regulators, or actually, like, you know, policymakers introduced maximum loss limits. Let's say in the Netherlands, now, an adult, like 25 plus, cannot deposit more than 700 euros a month. But there might be, or there most likely are some, who deposit 700, but they clearly can't afford to deposit 700.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing you talked about was these contrasting perspectives where somebody might not spend that much relative to their income, but report a high PGSI. I think that's certainly a plausible scenario because it's difficult to know how much somebody's allocating to other expenses, what debts they've got, and so on. The high spend, low PGSI is interesting. I think there's more of a case for potentially suggesting people aren't either being honest or perhaps they don't have insight into the impact of their behavior yet, or it's not materialized, the negative consequences of them spending lots of money on gambling. And I've seen that, again, we've got some sort of preliminary research that we're sitting on that where we asked people about their expenditure. We did the sort of recall about how much they think they've spent in the past. We also asked them in the future, how much do you think you're going to spend? And how much do you think is going to be affordable to you? Like, how much could you comfortably lose? And one of the things we find is that people who immediately go on to lose more than they say they can afford, a large proportion of those, say 50%, didn't say that they've ever spent more than they can afford on the PGSI.
Wait, coming in. I couldn't follow the train of thought.
That's okay. So we're asking people, sports bettors, how much can you afford to lose in the next 30 days, like in the next month? Mm-hmm. And then they go on then to lose more than that. Mm-hmm. So we've got this group that they're clearly spending beyond their means, it seems. Mm-hmm. And then when we look back at their PGSI data, they've told us that they've never spent more than they can afford. Yeah. But then they've also done that in the months prior as well. So it suggests that people maybe aren't, they don't have a great insight even that they're spending more than they can actually afford. So and we know that from the recall research that shows that people really drastically underestimate how much they're spending month to month. In terms of then loss limits and affordability checks, I think the premise makes sense, and I'm supportive of them. But I think in practice, I know there's been some concerns in the UK, for example, how the affordability checks are working. And I think it just needs to be done really carefully and based on empirical evidence. So like, for example, what should the line be? What should the cutoff actually be for these checks when they're implemented, or these monthly caps on expenditure? They don't seem to be, it doesn't seem to be that much thought behind what the value is. In the UK, it's just based on what the average, basically income left over after the major expenses would be. So it's very general. It's not based on risk profiling or anything like that. It's just an estimation of how much money people could generally afford to lose.
I mean, you brought up a good point. You mentioned recall research, and that's, you know, when I started, so that was one of my first papers, and you published a couple of them too. I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to compare a person's, recalled spending with the actual spending? And if the person has a bad idea, you know, how much they spend, or if they underestimate it, then something must be wrong here, no? And that's clearly something, you know, that could also sort of feed into this, into, you know, the algorithms in a way. Okay, I mean, did you do that actually in one of your papers, that you'd sort of use that as a predictive variable, how well were they able to recall their own spending?
Yeah, so in our latest machine learning study, we built models just using the like routine behavioral tracking data that operators would use. But then we also then tried adding in some information from the survey, just these responses to single item questions that an operator could plausibly ask their customers, or a regulator could ask them, and or require an operator to ask their customers. So things like, how many other gambling accounts, for example, do you have other than this one? Which we found was a really strong predictor of problem gambling status. as well as we include an income variable in there. So the percentage, so we asked people about their income, and then we then computed their average monthly percentage of their income that they were depositing into their accounts. Interestingly, that wasn't one of the more important variables. It was sort of 14th ranked in terms of most importance. And those variables where we asked people how much they think they'd spent, and then we compared that with their actual expenditure and created a sort of discrepancy variable, that discrepancy was much, much more predictive of problem gambling than the affordability measure of percentage of income being spent, which we thought was really interesting. And they were more informative than just overall the amount, how much somebody was spending. So this misunderstanding of your expenditure, really often underestimating how much you're spending, does seem to be a signal. At least that's what we found in our research.
Which metric did you ask them for? Because spending can be interpreted quite differently.
Yeah, that's a good question. So yeah, net outcome is really is one of the measures that we included, but we do find people seem to misunderstand that to some extent. Then we had deposit and withdrawal, and those in particular were particularly predictive, especially withdrawal for some reason. People who misunderstand how much money they're withdrawing from their accounts seem to, for some reason, it seems to be very, very strongly associated with problems.
Because I also found, because I published like one paper, I think it was, or two, about where we ask for the amount bet, but nobody can have any. I mean, in sports betting, it's more likely, but as soon as you dive into casino gambling, amount bet, it means nothing because it's re-gambling, the winnings. But deposit and withdrawal, in my opinion, is the more important metric because a person can have some idea how much money they transfer from their bank account, credit card into a gambling account and how much money goes back.
And yeah, I was just going to say, the research that we've done on this, I think I can't remember the exact figures, but it's something like for every PGSI score that goes up, there's a 25% greater increase in that discrepancy. So people start to underestimate how much they're depositing by 25% more with each additional PGSI score.
But, if you think, prior actually to problem gambling. So let's say if we would clearly sort of want to focus now on preventing problem gambling, then what this outcome means is that operators should actually emphasize transparency, doesn't it? Like, knowledge, insights into somebody's spending. So they should really introduce mandatory summary statements, feedback, nudging, all that kind of stuff, which has increased lately, over the last couple of years. So many regulators require online gambling operators to inform players regularly about their spending. But in my opinion, much more could be done. And that could, I'm pretty convinced, prevent at least some individuals of losing track of their spendings.
Yeah, absolutely. In Australia, one of the positive things they've done is since 2022, they've required all online sites to send their customers these monthly summaries. They're called activity statements. And they just sent once a month via email. And you click on a link and it gives you this PDF document that summarizes over the last month in detail how much money they won or lost. And then over the last 6 months, a bit of a sort of overall summary. There's a bit of an issue with inconsistency across operators in terms of how they calculate things like net outcome. They all do it slightly differently. Overall, if the information's slightly messy and inconsistent. But I think it's definitely a positive step forward. We've done some research evaluating them, and we find that the uptake of them is much higher. I think they're much less sort of threatening to people because they are just pure information. It's not sort of suggesting anybody needs to restrict their behavior or anything like that. So it's much more palatable to a sort of wider customer base. And we find that, again, more than 50% of people say they're reading them reasonably regularly. Unfortunately, people who report having gambling problems are the least likely to use them, but they're the most likely to say that they benefited from reading them.
Yeah.
So we just ask people like simple questions. Mm. Did you change your gambling behavior as a result of reading your statements? And the people who reported problems were much, much more likely to say, yes, I reduced my gambling because of them. Mm. And very, very few people said that they would actually increase their gambling after reading this, because there was some concern, I think, from the industry in particular, that if you show people how much they're losing, they're going to start loss chasing. It's going to be this sudden realization, oh no, I need to chase those losses. But that doesn't seem to be what's happened at all.
I mean, one critique that regularly comes up when I present this is that they would sort of ask whether somebody who lost very little might, you know, start losing more, because especially when you present like normative feedback, when you tell somebody, okay, this is what you did and this is what comparable individuals are doing, and if you do much less, then, you know, the person might, but then I'm arguing, okay, that don't really matter, you know, if a person spends very little, and you naturally have a regression to the mean. Like, this is a known statistical phenomenon that, you know, extreme behavior tends to regress towards the mean in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. We don't have any of that sort of normative information in these at the moment. But from what we're seeing, people seem to find them useful. They seem to benefit from them. As you know, from speaking to Sally, she's doing some work to try and collate them and combine them from across sites, because that's one of the things people are particularly interested in, is we know people use lots of different sports betting sites. So therefore, having these isolated statements across different sites isn't that useful. They want to be able to combine and collate them and actually have an overall summary of what their expenditure is.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think this is the biggest challenge, but probably, room service. I just have to quickly go in.
All right. Whilst Michael's gone, I'm going to comment on one thing he said earlier then quickly, John, if you're happy with that.
Bring it on.
So one of the things that Michael mentioned was about when we do this research trying to predict problem gambling using operator data, we find really high rates of problem gambling scores, like 20-30% of the population report problem gambling. And I think obviously that's contrasting with population surveys, which suggest that rate is 1%. And I think it is actually indeed much higher than 1% when we look at regular gambling customers. Of course, it's the target population of interest who's going to be experiencing these problems. But one other thing that might be slightly inflating those risks is we've done some research that shows that the people who do choose to take part in these surveys, they tend to just be much more involved customers. And that makes perfect logical sense, but I don't think anybody had done that research previously. And it's a really interesting scenario, because in any other sort of survey environment, you wouldn't be able to know much about the people who don't respond to your survey, particularly about the behavior that you're interested in surveying them about. But with an operator, you can send out a survey and then they can give you the data for everyone, regardless of whether they take part in the survey or not. And that's what we did, and we showed that the 2,000 people or so that took part in our survey were just much, much more regular, involved, and more recent bettors than those who opted not to.
Yeah, I mean, in any study, you know, anything, you know, that's being studied online, whether, you know, it's about, okay, who clicks this button, who uses this product, who fills out the questionnaire, you'll always have the more active ones more likely to participate, to partake. And one mustn't sort of, you know, generalize the percentage of problem gamblers to the general population of gambling, because like you say, you know, you send out a request to answer a survey to 10,000 players, 20% participate, and those 20% are among the ones who, you know, just, you know, interact more often with the site, and they are more likely to click anything, they are more likely to set the limit and whatever. That's just, you know, the bias that's always going to be there, because if somebody is irregularly there or rarely there, they are less likely to participate. And then, of course, I mean, if you look at the PGSI, and especially, I mean, the other day I went actually through an Australian report on gambling and gambling harm, right, from 25. And then I was like, the numbers were like crazy. And they're like, what the fuck's going on here? And then I checked the method. And they really categorized something as risky gambling from PGSI 1. Like if somebody scores 1 point on the PGSI, which means any of the 9 questions they ask, they answer with sometimes, they are risky gamblers. I mean, in my opinion, this completely dilutes the results and defeats the purpose. If I'm really, really interested to find something out about, okay, gambling harm, or what causes more gambling harm, you know, which population, you know, is more likely to report gambling harm, don't you think? Like if you like completely lower the thresholds for problem gambling or risky gambling, I mean, you won't be able to identify any useful results, because then at the end of the day, everybody, you know, is a problem gambler who is sort of somehow, you know, use gamblers or has, you know, family members who do so.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, this is a big and controversial topic at the moment in the field, and I think doing it that way with the PGSI does potentially like mislead you. You're going to get some you're not getting the signal for what we're trying to actually look for. Like you say, we're not really picking up people who are genuinely experiencing harm or problems. At the same time, I think there has been some good research in Australia which has tried to look at harms more diversely and more across the spectrum of harms that people might experience. And has done a better job of capturing that than research that just uses the PGSI. Again, this is a really different scenario to what we're talking about earlier, trying to like identify those higher risk customers. But if you're just trying to understand harm at a population level, I think there's been some real advancements in that, in trying to capture, for example, the harm that other people experience from people's gambling, as well as these sort of legacy harms that continue. We know in the PGSI, we're just asking people about the past 12 months, things that have happened to them with their gambling. But we know there are plenty of people who've experienced pretty severe gambling problems, and many years later, sometimes even decades later, they're dealing with those consequences. So I think that definitely sort of inflates the rates of harm across a population when we start to look at it from that perspective. But again, it comes back to like, what are we trying to do? Are we trying to look at this from a public health perspective and enumerate all the harm in the population, and there's value in doing that, and it helps us to understand the wider impact of gambling harm. But from a risk identification point, that's obviously not very useful, because what we want to know is who's at risk right now and who do we need to intervene with at this moment.
What do you think actually about the period of time that should be considered? Because gambling screens refer to the last 12 months of behavior. So in practically, an online gambling operator assesses a player, let's say, on a daily basis, right? And if they looked at the last 12 months of behavior, somebody, you know, might have gambled 6 months ago extremely, met the criteria, but then they have been dormant for 6 months. You know, like often, I mean, the practical sort of, you know, application of these algorithms might, you know, be a little bit different from, let's say, you know, the theoretical approach, because if they score players or if they assess potentially problem gambling, that should also lead to action, no? Because why would they do it even? So what do you think, like, which time period is best to consider?
Yeah, this is another really interesting topic. So I'll just talk about our research, then I'll talk about the practicalities of how these models work in practice. So when we were reviewing the literature on this, we were looking at what time periods are people using, like what historical windows of information are people trying to use to predict problem gambling. And usually, like the saying is, more data is better. We can do more with that. We can probably make more accurate predictions. But I'm not so sure in the context of problem gambling for that, some of the reasons you started to allude to about like dormancy and things like that. And a lot of papers have used this 12-month window. We only had about sort of 8 months of pre-survey data, so we restricted it to 6 months just to be a nice sort of even reasonable number to look at. But then we also said, what happens if we just isolate the 30 days prior to the survey as well and use that just to try and create a scenario that was a bit more representative of what might be happening in practice. And we know that a large proportion of an operator's customer base are going to be people who've signed up recently. You know, people sign up, they close their accounts. That's a regular thing that happens. So there are going to be people that don't have that much data. And we need to know then, therefore, if these models are going to work when we're just looking at these shorter windows, or if we can only do it when we've got 12 months of data available, which is obviously really practically just infeasible and just seems silly, because we're not going to wait 12 months before we start including every individual in these models. And interestingly, what we found is that overall, they just performed pretty much the same. There wasn't that much difference between the 6 month and the 30-day model at all. If anything, the 30-day model was slightly better. It was slightly more accurate at picking up problem gambling.
Because if you, when you collect your labels, right, problem gambling status, players who answer most likely have gambled before, because sort of you wouldn't answer the questions if you didn't gamble, because then you wouldn't even visit the website. So what reflects in their response is what they most recently did. So for that reason, it totally makes sense to look at as recent behavior as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And I know, though we're asking people about the past 12 you months, there's almost certainly a bias and towards recent experiences.
Yeah. And I also think that, you know, some of the studies sort of predictive power is inflated, because think of this. Okay. So if you use the last 12 months of data, then all of the players, or the majority of the ones who didn't gamble recently, will have PGSI score 0 or very low, definitely not high risk, right? And this is kind of self-explanatory, right? You know, if you have a large population that's per definition low risk and you include them into the model, then you will have a very high predictive power. But that high predictive power doesn't help you in reality, because everybody who didn't gamble, I mean, that's not, you know, some information that's valuable at this very moment, right? Because what's valuable at this very moment is you have a person who did gamble and you want to know, okay, are they problem gamblers or not, per definition? Because that's the same issue I faced with my latest paper, where we had lottery online players, casino and sports betting. And there was a big chunk of players who only played the lottery online. And very few of those who exclusively play the online lottery reported problem gambling. If I had included these into the model and the information what type of game they played, I'd have built a perfect model. You know what I mean? Because all of the lottery players are non-problem gamblers. So it's like you said before, you know, and that's also sometimes, you know, when I read my model, I mean, not, you know, like, that doesn't, you know, only apply to what we're talking about now, but in general to prediction, to, you know, CRM tools, marketing tools, fraud detection, anything. If somebody says, my model is 95, 99% correct, I mean, you, that information is incomplete, you know, because of course, if I have 99% non-problem gamblers and I just say nobody's a problem gambler, I'm correct in 99% of the cases. But in how many cases of problem gamblers am I correct? That's why you need to report, okay, recall, you need to report precision, you know, specificity, sensitivity, those kinds of things, because it's about, okay, how correct are you actually in this group here, you know? I mean, And that's why the last 12 months, in my opinion, makes no sense, because if somebody didn't gamble last 30 days, they are very unlikely to be reporting problem gambling, and you include those in your model. I mean, everything is messed up. I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense from the operator's perspective as well to be scanning people who aren't gambling with them. It just practically makes no sense for them to be intervening potentially with these customers when they're not active in any way with them. But what the whole point is, they're trying to identify people who are engaging with their product who might be experiencing harm or risk. There's a couple of other things there. Another difficulty with this area is that I think one of the things that's going to start happening more and more is that we've got these single sort of behavioral indicators that are going to trigger a response, or operators that are going to, regulators that are going to require operators to respond to sort of real-time behavioral alerts. So when somebody does X behavior, for example, you need to intervene with them and speak to them. And that's really tricky from a research perspective to validate those behavioral indicators, because you can't just like immediately give the PGSI every time after somebody engages with that behavior. So you need to, there's always going to be sort of a lag between that occurring and then your outcome variable that's sort of predicting, whether that's PGSI or later self-exclusion or something like that. So I think that is a challenge that the research hasn't really addressed at the moment. There's no research on that as far as I'm aware, that sort of real-time detection of single behavioral indicators. It's more these sort of more complex models that are integrating multiple variables over time.
Yeah, so that's that's a ambivalence that I face all the time, that operators and regulators want to know why somebody is classified as a problem gambler, and you simply cannot provide thresholds, ranges, because it's multidimensional, right? So as soon as you have two variables in an equation, you can't say somebody is a problem gambler because they have lost more than 500 euros or something like this, because you have to take into account all the other variables which are in a model, that might be, gender, that might be the type of game. And that what you see now is a lot of regulators have started introducing, like what you said before, threshold-based approaches, because they are transparent to them. And in my opinion, it's simply because it's a lack of trust, Because if you, if your car, whatever car you have, breaks, okay, because it detects a object, or if you're, then you trust, okay, that this algorithm works, if it does it at the right point of time. But you don't start calling Elon Musk and asking him, hey, please, can I have a look at the algorithm, At which point of time does it break, what's the light conditions, what's the distance to the other car, how big has the object, does the object have to be, I just trust that it works, right? And the reason why they ask these questions is because they don't trust it, in my opinion, Because if you had an algorithm and said, okay, it's, or just like, you need antibiotics, because you had the surgery, you go to the pharmacy and you trust that these antibiotics are going to do the job, right? You don't go, and maybe some people, but very few would, sort of ask the pharmacist, okay, can I please see, all of the studies, how how well does this drug actually work? And so, because you go to the pharmacist, you get a prescription, you buy the medication, and you trust the medication will work. And that's what's missing, in my opinion, right? It's like this gold standard, because everybody does it, in a certain way. Every regulator comes up with different, rules which make more or less sense. And there is no calibration or anything, isn't it? And even like, we discussed this before, the ECPA markers of harm are so general that anybody can basically say that they are compliant with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. It is this simplicity. It allows you to say, oh, if somebody meets X criteria, therefore we're going to interact with them from a regulation perspective, that probably sounds very appealing. And yeah, like you say, the markers of harm, I think in theory, it sounds like a great idea, but there's no real operationalization of them. There's no like thresholds for them. And I think even
if you came up with thresholds, you are again defeating the purpose of algorithm, right? Because as soon as you have a threshold, then you can't, then, you know, it's an algorithm doesn't work like this. And everybody who tells me AI is explainable is full of shit, you know, because it's not. I mean, that's the purpose of the AI or of machine learning. I always give this example of the decision tree, you know, even a very simple decision tree has nonlinear elements in it, right? How can you explain young adults are higher likelihood than in the middle, lower, yeah, and olders are lower likelihood. Okay, you have nonlinearity. Now tell me, okay, is there one threshold there that tells you, okay, from that age you are more risk? No, because it's nonlinear. So either you trust it or you don't, you know, that's my response. Okay, you trust that it works, that it does what it detects, what it's supposed to detect, or you fall back to a very simple rule-based system where you'd say, okay, if somebody, you know, loses more than 1,000, per definition, you have to do something, you know. If somebody is a young adult and they lose more than 500, you have to do something. Then you fall back to basically, you know, a rule-based sort of, you know, system.
Yeah, yeah. There's always this trade-off between model performance and transparency. And there's been attempts in the gambling literature to try and use different techniques to add transparency to these models, but I just don't think they've been very good or very useful so far. Even these things that they say, okay, this is going to allow people to interpret the how these models work, they're
now,
really,
the human
really
brain is not meant the human brain is not meant to interpret complex relationships. It can't sort of, even in a two-dimensional space, you have really trouble describing it verbally.
Yeah, there is something I've been playing around with a little called conditional inference trees, and they essentially are like decision trees, but they show you the split points at every and it gives you this visual diagram. The overall performance of the model would be worse than if you use, say, like a random forest or an XGBoost or something like that, a more complicated model. This is just like a single tree, and it picks a single split point for every variable. It picks the most correlated variable with your outcome first of all, and then it picks the split point that best differentiates it, and it gives you this as this visual map, and you can tailor with it and then try and tinker with it and give you a map that's more or less interpretable, depending on how many layers and so on you want to include in there, how many people you want to be in the leafs or the buckets at the end of these maps. But I think that's one option potentially we could go down, but in terms of regulation, that would be really difficult to control and advise companies on. But internally for operators, it could be useful. For example, like a customer service person who's speaking to somebody could be able to really easily interpret this and say, like, I'm speaking to you because you deposited more than this, you're under this age, and you have used a credit card in the past month or something like that. It combines these indicators. You can see them and interpret them.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's you know what I've been toying around is basically to get, you know, like an AI, like a summary, you know, like you ask the system, okay, what's specific about this player? And then based on the model and the behavior, you get a summary that sort of interprets those cut points.
Yeah, the other thing you were talking about earlier is this, like, these metrics that we compute from these studies, like sensitivity or recall, specificity, precision, and so on. I think this is really interesting in this context to try and understand what level of these we should even be looking for. And I think that's one of the motivations for the systematic review that we're doing, is to try and just map how well are these models performing in these contexts, because in medical research, sensitivity and specificity are classed as like only acceptable if they reach 80%. And 90% is sort of deemed as being really good and ideal. But it seems pretty unreasonable to apply those same standards to gambling because, as you said, it's not this like all or nothing thing. It's not this biological entity that you can identify in somebody's body, for example. And there's also some differences in terms of the risks associated with misidentification here as well. Like if somebody doesn't get picked up, it's a problem. It's not ideal, but it's not sort of an immediate medical danger potentially. There's also no risk of like further contagion or something like that. And if you misclassify somebody as having a problem when they haven't, it doesn't trigger some medical response like it would if it was like a vaccine or a medical diagnostic test or something. Because problem gambling, as we've talked about, is somewhat of a subjective experience, again, it's going to vary what it looks like in terms of the behavior underpinning it and what's led to that experience for somebody. So I think trying to understand what's reasonable, what's the sort of minimum thresholds we should be looking for in terms of sensitivity and specificity would be a really admirable thing to be able to do in this context.
We discuss that next time, right, John? You seem nervous. Michael. You want to cut us off or what?
No. I'm the guys have just arrived to come and move my daughter's bed.
Are you sure? Are you just making this up?
No, they're definitely here. You'll hear them shortly. Or the cat who's freaking the fuck out.
All right.
It's a good time to cut short. I'm sorry I haven't been involved in the conversation much. I've been emptying my desk. And that's not a euphemism.
I could now comment on that, but you know, I will refrain from it.
It's my reality. And the removals guys are here. Oh, they're probably here now as well.
No, but I think I'm happy we stuck really to this topic because, as discussed before, there are, you know, other research topics I'd like to discuss with Rob. And we're going to do that next time.
Well, let's hope he'll agree to come back, because next time I might be more involved in the conversation and he might be like, fuck this, I'm out.
Well, I quite enjoyed your silence, John, you know, I have to say.
Yeah, bitch. Fucking doctors, you're all the same. I mean, apart from my GP. No, you're all the same. Rob, thank you very, very much for joining. Oh, I should say thank you for joining Michael. And you know, I'm halfway through clearing my desk, so okay, it's been a good morning.
Cool. Thanks.
Thanks. But we'll sort something out for a return visit soon. Thank you.